I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's October 27th, and we have a lot to talk about. We devote a lot of time on the podcast talking about MS research, and that often means that we're talking about clinical trials. And some of you may be wondering what happens in a phase 1 clinical trial or a phase 3 clinical trial, or how scientists know that a drug is even safe enough to start a clinical trial. So this week, we're going to break down the details of MS clinical research. We'll talk with Dr. Sandy Cassard, a research associate in the neurology department at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, and we'll talk with Diane Kramer, who's participated in more than 20 research studies since being diagnosed with MS in 2010. And while we're on the subject of MS research, I want to tell you about MS Translate. It's an outstanding online resource that features MS research news that's aimed at people who aren't scientists, which should sound like a pretty familiar description if you're a regular Real Talk MS listener. MS Translate is based in Australia, and it was launched 8 years ago by Brett Drummond, an MS research scientist himself, whose goal is to better connect the MS research and MS patient communities. You'll be hearing more about MS Translate in a couple of weeks when I interview Brett, and in the meantime, you can visit MS Translate at mstranslate.com.au and check out a lot of great content, including the video interview that Brett did with me. It was a great experience, and given our aligned goals, I wouldn't be surprised to see future collaborative efforts between Real Talk MS and MS Translate. And you'll find a link to MS Translate in today's show notes. You've probably heard me say more than once that the thing I really love about doing this podcast is that it gives me the opportunity to introduce you to people that I call difference makers. Whether they're making a difference in the lives of people affected by MS through their research, their clinical practice, their advocacy, or their fundraising efforts, these are extraordinary people who are creating change, driving progress, and moving the ball down the field when it comes to improving the lives of people affected by MS. And it turns out that I'm not the only one who's in the business of recognizing difference makers in the MS community. This year, to celebrate the 200th anniversary of the birth of nursing pioneer Florence Nightingale, the International Organization of Multiple Sclerosis Nurses has awarded 10 MS nurses who are difference makers with the 2020 Nightingale Award. Each of these nurses has accomplished something special by creating life-changing health, mobility, and social programs for people living with MS. And with this award, pharmaceutical company EMD Serono is providing financial support to fund these 10 innovative programs. In a few minutes, we'll meet Michelle Keating. Michelle is a recently retired nurse from Mercy St. Louis, and she's a Nightingale Award recipient for her work as the founder of MS Bright Spots of Hope. But before we get to my guests, I need to have a quick conversation with all the Real Talk MS listeners here in the United States, because the most important thing that each of you can do to protect your quality of life and ensure your future access to healthcare is to remember to vote. I know a lot of you are like me and you've already voted. But if you haven't cast your vote yet, I probably don't have to remind you that we're not only 1 week away from what is sure to be a historic election, but we're 2 weeks away from the day that President Trump and the Department of Justice join 20 Republican state attorneys general in urging the Supreme Court to eliminate the Affordable Care Act and take away all of the protections for people living with MS and every other pre-existing medical condition. Just a few weeks ago, President Trump announced that he was going to protect people with pre-existing conditions by issuing an executive order stating that it is the United States policy to protect people with pre-existing medical conditions. Well, I don't want to accuse the president of issuing an executive order designed to fool people into thinking that he's doing something that he really isn't, But unfortunately, that executive order has absolutely no power whatsoever to protect people with pre-existing conditions. Now, many of you have already heard my rant about this a few weeks ago on Real Talk MS episode 161. So instead of sharing my thoughts, I want to read you part of a letter that the National MS Society, along with 17 other patient advocacy organizations, sent to President Trump after he issued his executive order. I'm quoting directly from a portion of that letter now. "We are deeply troubled that the administration and the Department of Justice have declined to defend the constitutionality of many of the Affordable Care Act provisions that directly protect people with pre-existing conditions. While we note the executive orders released by the White House on September 24th, which purport to protect patients with pre-existing conditions and prevent the practice of surprise medical billing, the orders do neither, as they hold no force of law. What is most concerning is that while the administration communicates support for patients with pre-existing conditions, the administration has continually targeted provisions of the Affordable Care Act that protect patients. These attacks on existing protections, combined with the lack of progress toward enacting policies that would meaningfully improve or protect coverage for patients in Congress or through regulation, puts people with pre-existing conditions in danger of losing reliable access to care they need. In recent years, the administration has also promoted insurance plans, such as short-term, limited-duration plans and association health plans, that are allowed to discriminate against people with pre-existing conditions. The administration has ignored misleading marketing practices by those selling substandard insurance, reduced funding for programs that help consumers enroll in coverage that meets their needs, and laid the groundwork for taxpayer dollars to subsidize these products that undercut those insurers that are actually providing comprehensive plans. Combined, these policies have eroded access to affordable and comprehensive care for people with pre-existing conditions. We cannot ignore that even during the COVID-19 pandemic, when the need is arguably the greatest, some people in America still do not have accessible, adequate, and affordable coverage. That number of un- and underinsured Americans will skyrocket if the Affordable Care Act is overturned. And despite last week's symbolic gestures, these actions do nothing to prevent discrimination against patients. Our patients cannot afford to go back to an era where people with pre-existing conditions can be discriminated against. People with pre-existing conditions need real protections, and it is past time for the administration and Congress to protect and expand upon those already in law. If the administration wishes to meaningfully engage and protect patients, we recommend the Department of Justice correct course and move swiftly to fully defend and protect the Affordable Care Act in the courts." That letter was met with deafening silence from President Trump and his administration. So I hope you recognize that when you vote for president and for your congressional candidates, you're voting for the viability, affordability, and availability of your future health care. And to be clear, choosing to vote for candidates from the Democratic Party won't stop the Supreme Court from ruling as it will. But in the event that the Affordable Care Act is struck down, you just have to ask yourself which party, which candidates are most likely going to do what it takes to pass new legislation that will ensure that those protections for people with pre-existing conditions are strengthened and immediately reinstituted. Please, please vote on or even before November 3rd. As scientists around the world are continuing to analyze data from COVID-19 MS patient registries, national studies, and other sources, the Multiple Sclerosis International Federation has just issued an updated global COVID-19 advisory for people living with MS. This guidance covers COVID-19 risk factors that people with MS should consider, advice regarding the use of different disease-modifying therapies during the pandemic, and that advice is based on evidence that shows some MS disease-modifying therapies increase the chance of developing a more severe case of COVID-19. The advisory also includes preventative steps that people with MS should take to avoid the virus. I hope you'll take a moment to review this updated global guidance, and you'll find that link in today's show notes. And if you happen to have the Real Talk MS app, which is available as a free download at either the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store, then you've already received your own copy of this global COVID-19 advisory under the Bonus Content tab. Compared to Caucasians with MS, African Americans with MS are more likely to experience more relapses, greater disability, and often require mobility assistance earlier in their disease course. And newly published research results may provide one clue as to why that is. We know that there's a genetic component to MS. It isn't fully understood, but scientists do understand that genes play a role in determining who is susceptible to developing MS, and genes may also influence the course of the disease. So a research team used data from a 2005 genetic study of African Americans with MS that was completed by the International MS Genetics Consortium, and they also analyzed a separate 2007 study of African Americans with MS. And they discovered two important gene variants in African Americans with MS who have European ancestors. Well, there's a lot more work to be done here, and that work won't happen without research participants. If you're an African American living with MS, you can help by contacting the University of California at San Francisco MS Genetics Research Laboratory at msgenetics.ucsf.edu/research, or you can call 866-674-3637. And I'll include a link to the study results as well as to the UCSF MS Genetics Research Lab in today's show notes. And the results of a wholly separate MRI study at the University of Texas Health Sciences Center show that when compared to Caucasian MS patients, Hispanic MS patients are at a higher risk for developing more aggressive forms of MS at an earlier age. The study also showed that Hispanic MS patients are likely to face more significant clinical disability than Caucasian patients. In this study, the research team compared brain MRI scans for 94 Hispanic MS patients with 94 age and gender-matched Caucasian MS patients, and the team found differences. They even found that Hispanic MS patients transitioned from relapsing remitting MS to secondary progressive MS at a younger age, roughly when they're 39 years old, compared to Caucasian MS patients in the study who transitioned to secondary progressive MS at an average age of 43. And these study results weren't limited to the clinical impact of MS. The researchers also point out that because Hispanic MS patients are at a higher risk for developing ambulatory disability, they're at a higher risk of losing their employment. So the results of this study point to both a direct health impact and a socioeconomic impact on Hispanics living with MS. And if you'd like to review the study results, you'll find a link in today's show notes. It's worth noting that everything we know about multiple sclerosis is a result of people with MS choosing to participate in clinical research. When it comes to MS and most every other chronic illness, clinical research is the common denominator to all medical progress. And that's why I was excited to talk about what it means to conduct clinical research and participate in clinical research with my guests, Dr. Sandy Cassard and Diane Kramer. In a moment, we'll hear that conversation. We all get very excited at the announcement that a new disease-modifying therapy has received its FDA approval. But I think it's important to keep in mind that the FDA approval is the final step in a very long, very thorough, and very expensive clinical trial process. And if we didn't have these necessary clinical trials, we wouldn't have the prescription medications that we rely on. My guests today are Dr. Sandy Cassard, a research associate in the neurology department at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, and Diane Kramer, who was diagnosed with MS in 2010 and has been involved in MS research studies at Johns Hopkins and Penn State. Diane leads an MS support group. She's an MS activist, a bike and walk MS team captain, and a National MS Society Pennsylvania Keystone Chapter trustee. And if you want some insight into Diane's mindset when it comes to living with MS, please consider this. Diane spent 11 years working as a nurse until her medical retirement in 2017. But Diane keeps her Pennsylvania nursing license current in preparation for her life without MS. Diane, Dr. Cassard, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, John. Thanks for having us.
Dr. Cassard, we often talk about a new phase one clinical trial getting started or the results of a phase three clinical trial being announced. Can you take us through the different phases of a clinical trial and help us understand what each phase is about?
Certainly. So a phase one trial is often the first in human study that focuses on the safety of a drug or a device, and it's limited to a small number of participants. On the order of 20 participants, maybe up to 100. A phase two trial is conducted on a larger group of participants with the condition, and it includes safety and efficacy measures. Efficacy refers to how well it works. Then there's a phase three trial. That's a much larger trial. It's usually on the order of 1,000 to 3,000 participants. It seeks to confirm and expand on the findings from the phase two trials. The focus is on safety and effectiveness, and it compares the experimental drug with one or more commonly used approved treatment. And then there is a phase four trial as well. This is part of the post-marketing surveillance of a drug after FDA approval. Sometimes the FDA requires a pharmaceutical company to collect additional safety data after approval. It focuses on the drug's risks, the benefits, and optimal use of it.
Before a clinical trial even begins, how do scientists know that an experimental drug is safe enough to be tested on humans in a phase one clinical trial?
So prior to phase one safety trials, drugs and devices are tested in the preclinical environment, which includes the basic science or bench research and animal research. In the case of a new drug, this includes lab testing of the physical and chemical properties of the drug. It's followed by testing in animal models. And MS studies are often done in the mouse model as the animal model of choice.
We often hear about the FDA approving a new medication based upon the results of a clinical trial. But does the FDA have any involvement in that trial before the approval process?
Absolutely. The FDA regulates the drug development approval process in the United States. And in the case of drugs, their role begins when an investigational new drug application, or IND, is submitted by a pharmaceutical company or an investigator to study a drug in humans. The FDA has about 30 days to respond after an IND application has been submitted, and trials may begin after 30 days if the FDA does not put any restrictions on them from starting. The IND holders, pharmaceutical industry or individual investigators submit annual progress reports that include any safety issues identified. They submit these to the FDA through the life of the trial. And ultimately, they may submit a new drug application for marketing to the FDA for approval if the phase three trials show promising findings for the drug under study.
Dr. Cassard, why is participation in clinical trials so important?
Participation in clinical trials is essential to move the science in the field forward and to improve the lives of people living with the condition under study.
Diane? What got you interested in participating in clinical trials?
Well, I think what first got me interested in participating in clinical trials was my neurologist offering it to me. I had moved between several different neurologists early on in my diagnosis of MS, and I was looking for something more. And my neurologist that I had ended up with actually was a leading researcher in multiple sclerosis. So I wanted to know what more I could do. I was already eating better and on a disease modifier and going to physical therapy. And being a part of research meant that I could be one step closer to the cures for multiple sclerosis.
So once you agree to be in a clinical trial, Diane, what's it like to be a participant?
It's a lot of conversations about what that trial is going to entail. There's a lot of conversations about safety measures, about the procedure, what you are signing up for, basically. It's a lot of learning about who is on your clinical trial team and how to reach out to them if you have issues or more questions. It's just a very big learning process, being a clinical trial volunteer.
What do you consider to be the benefit of your participation in research studies?
I think the biggest benefit is it gives me that first row seat to breakthrough. It allows me to lend my very unique perspective and experience to possibly coming closer to remyelination or better everyday living or a new medication. It gives me that front row seat, though, is the biggest benefit.
Diane, there are some people listening to our conversation who are saying to themselves, hey, I get it. Clinical trials are important, but I already have my hands full just dealing with my MS. I don't have any extra bandwidth to participate in clinical research. What would be your message to those people?
My message to those people is that volunteering is an experience unlike any other. But it is also not a complete drain on your time. It's as invasive or intrusive as you want it to be. And it can be as simple as filling out surveys while you're sitting on your couch. That is actually the first thing that I recommend to people that are interested in stepping into volunteering for studies is to start by answering some surveys. You have a unique perspective that needs to be passed on to others.
Consider this if you're listening. Every step we take toward finding better treatments and eventually finding a cure for MS is 100% reliant on clinical research. Without clinical trials, progress stops. And by choosing to participate in a clinical trial, you're choosing to be part of those breakthroughs. You become someone who actually enables new treatments to be discovered. You personally take us that much closer to a cure. Dr. Sandy Cassard and Diane Kramer, thank you for helping us better understand why choosing to participate in MS research is choosing to participate in creating a brighter future. And thanks for talking with me today.
Thank you.
Thanks, John.
As I mentioned at the top of this episode, the thing that I love most about hosting Real Talk MS is the opportunity to introduce real difference makers to the Real Talk MS listener community. Nightingale Award recipient Michelle Keating is a difference maker, and MS Bright Spots of Hope, the nonprofit organization that Michelle started, is making a difference every day in the lives of so many people who are affected by MS. In a moment, we'll meet my special guest, Michelle Keating. Michelle Keating is a recently retired nurse from Mercy, St. Louis. She's a founder of MS Bright Spots of Hope, and Michelle is also a 2020 Nightingale Award recipient. Welcome to the podcast, Michelle.
Thank you, John. I'm really honored to be here with you today.
Well, first, I want to congratulate you on being named one of this year's Nightingale Award recipients. And before we talk about MS Bright Spots of Hope, I'd like to talk about you for a moment. I just mentioned that you're recently retired. So how long were you an MS nurse, and what originally motivated you to specialize in working with people who are living with MS?
Well, I have been a nurse for 41 years and specifically working with people with MS, probably about 20 years. I did that work in addition to my work at Mercy, where I was an oncology nurse. In my MS nursing, I helped people on the field with some of the pharmaceutical support programs, as well as being an educator and advocate for people with MS.
I understand that you yourself have a connection to people with MS. Is that correct?
Well, you have guessed that correctly, John. I've been living with MS for 39 years, so I certainly understand the challenges and struggles that people with MS face every day. And in my years of working with people with MS, as you know, no two people are the same. And my struggles and my challenges have been difficult at times, but I feel what's most important is always focusing on the positive and moving forward. We can't get stuck in anger or frustration or depression. Those are real feelings that have to be dealt with. But I think it's really important to focus on what we can do, because there's so many things. My career has been extremely rewarding living with MS.
I think that's a wonderful perspective to have. And as you know far better than I, given your years of experience, sometimes mindset is a very powerful medicine, and your mindset seems to be as good as it could possibly be. And I think that's wonderful. So let's talk a little bit about MS Bright Spots of Hope. And a good place to start is asking you what it's all about and why you decided to start MS Bright Spots of Hope.
Sure. Well, MS Bright Spots of Hope is a 501c3 nonprofit whose mission is to educate, empower, inspire, spark creativity, and enhance wellness for people with MS, with the caveat of true positive role models. I think that's so important that people with MS need positive role models to help them achieve their goals and help them be educated, inspired by others. So that really sparked in me, through my work with MS patients and cancer patients, the need for that specific mission. And so that's how we began. We began with MS Evening of Hope, which is an inspirational night of music, dinner, speakers, and sharing. We also started with a program called Many Steps Towards Hope, which was educating people on walking difficulties, mobility impairment, and offering, again, some role models who helped learn how to exercise and keep mobility. And that was an important program. That, because of that, we spun off MS Fitness Friends, which is a fitness group that meets once a month. Now, again, during the pandemic, we are meeting twice a month on Zoom. And of course, I think that's been a critical factor in keeping people moving forward. So those are just a few of our programs.
What made you decide to start MS Bright Spots of Hope? I've known an awful lot of nurses, and from what I understand, you guys have your hands full already. So what made you decide to do this as well?
I have to say, it's just my personal passion and my personal calling, I believe, God-given calling, to really go ahead with this mission. I actually talked to several people who had started a nonprofit, kind of did my homework behind the scenes to see what it was going to be all about. And I honestly feel that we're moving in the right direction, because in 4 years, we've grown from just a couple of programs to a number of programs. We've expanded our network. And of course, now with things being virtual, other people around the country can find out about our programs and participate. And I just feel that we will keep moving in the direction that I'm being led, and we are being led by as an organization to really keep people in balance of mind, body, and spirit. So important.
Well, I understand you're planning quite an ambitious cycling adventure. Can you tell me about that?
We are so excited that I received the Florence Nightingale Award. That will help partially fund our bicycling adventure to Colorado. It'll be a first-time event, a pilot event, actually, because we're hoping if it's successful, we'll be able to expand. This adventure will start in Colorado Springs. Seven people and their support partners from the St. Louis metropolitan area will be headed to Colorado Springs, and we will meet at a specialized bike shop called Angle Tech, and they have all kinds of recumbent bikes. They have tandem bikes. They have bikes that are can be pedaled with your hands. They specialize in adaptive bikes. And so they've agreed to work with us, and everyone will be custom fitted with the right kind of bike. And there's some trails that are very close by. We'll be cycling on the trails. We'll have an opportunity to take a van tour through the Garden of Scott. And we'll just be together for a few days, which will, I think, make this particular adventure become a community. And that's a really exciting opportunity for us.
Well, I was about to ask you what you envision as perhaps the biggest takeaway that participants are going to come away from this experience with, but I think you just told me. So this is really all about building or enhancing community.
Enhancing community and giving people the courage and inspiration to try something new, whether they develop cycling as a habit or just being exposed to the opportunity of travel with a disability, whatever comes of this adventure, I think there's going to be so many benefits to people with MS and the support partners.
It sounds as though the proceeds from the Nightingale Award are going toward a very, very worthwhile experience for the participants, and not just the people going, but the people who are going to be interested in following you, hearing about it, learning more about it, because I think even if you're not on that adventure, you can be inspired by that adventure.
I hope that will be true. We hope to have some filming of ourselves and, you know, filming during the program so that we can share that in some way on social media or other avenues to get the word out while we're doing the adventure that's kind of being developed and how we're going to proceed with that. But we're really excited.
Well, I love how in a relatively short period of time, just a few years, you have really grown, branched out, developed new programs. So I have to ask, what do you think is next for MS Bright Spots of Hope?
Oh, of course you would ask me that. Well, honestly, as I said before, I truly feel a lot of the way that we expand is based on the connections that happen. I recently connected with a nurse who won an award in California at the IMSN from that organization. And we connected, and she is a small nonprofit for people with MS also. We've already connected and talked about doing an evening of hope in her community. I've been called, and we did an evening of hope in Atlanta, Georgia. And my hope is that these programs, as we bring them to other areas, they're not about Bright Spots being the program. They're about the local community taking on these programs and developing them into a network that then they carry on in areas. Same thing with the fitness friends. I'd love to see that grow. I'd love to see other fitness groups develop. That would be awesome.
Well, how can people find out more about MS Bright Spots of Hope?
Well, probably the best way to find out about it is to visit our website, msbrightspotsofhope.org. We also have a Facebook page, and we have a YouTube channel, which has a number of videos about Bright Spots, as well as the recorded Fitness Friends videos that we have done in the past couple of months. And I would love for people, if they're available, to join us virtually at our programs. They can sign up online. All the registration information is on our website.
And I'm going to make sure we include a link to that website in our show notes to make it really easy for our listeners to find your website. I have to admit, I've taken a look at some of those videos, and you can't help but be enthused and inspired just watching them. So you've certainly made one fan already, and I think you're going to make a lot more as people find out about MS, Bright Spots of Hope. Michelle Keating.
Thank you so much,
John. Well, Michelle Keating, I can't thank you enough for all that you've done, not only throughout your career, but certainly in taking on a whole new endeavor to make life better and create hope for people affected by MS. Thanks for that. And thanks for taking a few minutes to talk with me today.
Thanks again, John, for the chance to inspire and offer some information to your listeners. And I welcome the opportunity to participate in additional webcasts and listen to your program regularly now. Thank you so much.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/165. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into your email or text. I don't think I have to tell anyone listening to this podcast that the COVID-19 pandemic has intensified and in some cases multiplied the challenges of living with MS. More than ever before, people living with MS need access to reliable information, support, and connection. We're witnessing that even during a pandemic, MS doesn't stop, and neither does the National MS Society. With vital funding from supporters like you, the National MS Society is continuing to meet the urgent and expanding needs of the MS community during these unprecedented times, while ensuring that the MS research community rebounds quickly from COVID-19, so that the progress and momentum toward finding a cure continues. And that's why I hope that as you're able, you'll make a donation to the Society's COVID-19 Response Fund. It couldn't be easier. Just text the word GIVE to 68686, and you'll get a link right to the MS Society's COVID-19 Response Fund webpage. I hope you'll consider contributing today, because it's never been more important. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. And if you're listening in the U.S., please make sure you vote.